For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. At least 29 people have been killed and dozens injured in a car bomb outside a bank in Afghanistan's Helmand province. The bomb detonated at New Kabul Bank in Lashkargah and reportedly killed civilians and security personnel. Both the Taliban and Islamic State have been targeting Afghanistan with attacks in recent months. The destruction of an ancient mosque in Mosul is an official declaration of defeat by the Islamic State. That's according to Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. Iraqi forces say the Islamic State blew up the Great Mosque of An-Nuri as pro-government troops advance into Mosul's old city. That's the last enclave for IS in what used to be the group's final major urban stronghold in Iraq. The mosque was over 800 years old, and it was where the Islamic State declared a caliphate in 2014. UK Prime Minister Theresa May is expected to present fellow EU leaders with a generous offer to safeguard the rights of European citizens living in Britain. She's at a summit in Brussels. Officially, EU leaders aren't discussing the terms of Brexit at the summit, but they will decide how to relocate EU agencies currently based in London. Elena Casas reports from Brussels.
The British Prime Minister has promised to come to Brussels with what she's called a generous offer to the 3 million European citizens living in the UK. But EU negotiators have said that anything that falls short of being able to carry on with their lives exactly as if Brexit had not happened will not be good enough. May has said EU citizens' rights will be subject to UK law, meaning they could lose some current rights, like being able to bring a non-EU spouse to Britain without income tests, which British citizens cannot do. The terms of Brexit are not supposed to be on Thursday's agenda, which focuses on migration, security and defence cooperation, but the 27 leaders will meet without May after dinner.
Tests on UK tower blocks after the blaze in London last week have shown many are covered in cladding which could be combustible. Downing Street says 600 high-rises in England are using similar cladding to the Grenfell Tower. UK Prime Minister Theresa May says this has been revealed in tests carried out after the fire at the block which killed at least 79 people. It's been speculated the Grenfell blaze spread so quickly because of cladding on the outside of the tower. And the Prime Minister's told the House of Commons it's an issue now being looked for elsewhere.
As a precaution, the government has arranged to test cladding in all relevant tower blocks. Mr. Speaker, shortly before I came to the chamber, I was informed that a number of these tests have come back as combustible. The relevant local authorities and local fire services have been informed.
For more on this story, you can follow me on Twitter, at Ollie Barrett. From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Ollie Barrett, and a warm welcome to the programme to your good self. 22nd of June 2017. It's cooler today, baby. It's cooler. It's a much more pleasant studio to be in. I might be a bit more awake than I was yesterday. Welcome to the programme. This is your Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, and TuneIn Radio. How are you?
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. The Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
And I received many a note from you today telling me you watched Franken Skies, the film by Matt Landman, which we discussed with Matt himself on the program last night. And the verdict is good. You're very impressed with his film. Share it around. Let other people see it. That was Matt from last night. Tonight, in around about 30 minutes' time, David Shaler will join me, former MI5 agent, of course, journalist and author, and among other things, he'll be talking about shocking new breaking news that he has uncovered about the relationship between Salman Abedi, who blew up himself and killed many people, of course, at the Manchester Arena, 22 people. The relationship between him, his family and British intelligence. More news on that with David Shaler and more besides. from around about half past the hour, 25 minutes to the top of the hour, and David will stay with me then for an extended conversation. Lovely. We're broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2. I did say this, but I'm saying it again. Do bookmark davidicke.com/headlines. Listen to the terrific Fab Radio International. And of course, we're on TuneIn Radio, along with about 7 million other programmes and stations as well. Are you in good form? You are. Are you glad it cooled down a wee bit? Just a little bit. Do you feel a bit guilty, thinking, well, I've wished this bit of cold, cooler weather, and now we might not have any more summer. It was so rotten the last few days, particularly anybody working in the environment I work in, that it was a welcome relief today to walk out and feel a cool breeze on your face. I enjoyed it. Anyway, today, so let's crack on. Few things to talk about before we get David on the programme. And as usual, you can speak to me by contacting me on Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Best way to contact me during the live show. Now, as you might have heard Ollie Barrett discuss in the news, the Prime Minister is in Brussels. There's a summit there, expats' rights being discussed. But before all of that, the European Council President Donald Tusk quoted John Lennon. He channeled John Lennon and John Lennon's song Imagine, and suggested the door remains open for the UK to stay in the European Union. Everybody is saying that, including Emmanuel Macron, the new President of France. And ahead of this evening's summit, Donald Tusk said, "You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one." This is what's going to happen, you see. You know, Emmanuel Macron saying it's open for the UK to change its mind. Everybody and his or her sister, brother, uncles, aunt, twice removed, they're all saying it. If the UK wants to stay in, why shouldn't she? The official Brexit negotiations begin on Monday. That's this coming Monday. No, they didn't. They began on Monday. Yes, they began on Monday. Next week. They're going to do 1 week out of every month. Isn't that right? That's how much under pressure they are. That's how desperate they are to get a deal. Not. Now, just to clarify what Tusk said, it is a difficult process. We are prepared, the EU. There are different predictions coming from different people about the possible outcome, hard Brexit, soft Brexit, or no deal. Some of my British friends have even asked me whether Brexit could be reversed and whether I could imagine an outcome where the UK stays part of the EU. And he told them, did Donald Tusk. You see, Tusk didn't say, well, in fact, we should respect the will of the people in the referendum. He didn't say that. Of course, if he was a Democrat, if he believed in democracy, he would have said, listen, the decision was made. Let's get on with exit. But no, he didn't say that. He said the European Union was built on dreams. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I find them all very relaxed and jovial. Do you know why they're relaxed and jovial? Because they know, or they believe anyway, that the UK is not going to, and never will, leave the European Union. My predictions are not worth a 5p bet with your local bookie, but I'm going for a referendum late 2018. That's my guess anyway. Now, before heading off to Brussels to meet with her criminal counterparts, Theresa May did address the House of Commons on the response to the Grenfell Tower fire. And she also took questions from MPs on all sides of the House today. May told Parliament, and you heard this in the news, that there have been tests on high-rise buildings to see if the cladding on the buildings was flammable, and it's been found that 7 residential high-rises so far, in 4 local authority areas are covered in flammable cladding. Why is that? Why? Surely you and I, and I'm not going to call you surely we are not being asked to accept that the companies who carry out such maintenance, the companies who erect the cladding, wouldn't know the material was combustible and wouldn't know that it had been banned. You see, I have to believe that people who work in such an industry would be aware of breaking news and developments within their own industry, meaning they knew that material was flammable and they knew it had been banned. So why was it put up? And I believe it was put up, and I'm suspecting this, I have no proof, it was put up maybe without the knowledge of the contractors hired to do the job. Somebody has overseen the placement of combustible cladding on certain buildings, knowing that the law of averages meant or would mean that a fire would happen eventually. Why? To tear them down. To tear down the buildings. And often such corruption, you know, I can imagine a scenario where nobody meant anybody to be burned or to lose their life. I can imagine a scenario where people who wanted an excuse to begin the tearing down of those buildings didn't want to kill anybody. But put flammable cladding on certain buildings, knowing eventually there would be a fire. That's my opinion on it anyway. More on that in a second, right? Now, Theresa May, as part of her speech, stated clearly today that residents wouldn't have to leave the area or leave the borough, of course, if they didn't want to. She stated this pretty categorically.
Some survivors have said that they want to leave the local area, and we will, of course, support that and help them find a home elsewhere. But I want to be absolutely clear. Nobody is being forced to move somewhere they don't want to go. And if any honourable member thinks they know of anyone being treated in this way, they should contact my office in Downing Street with the details. Mr. Speaker, as the scale of the tragedy became clear, we quickly decided there had to be an independent public inquiry. As I said to the House yesterday, it will be chaired by a judge to get to the truth about what happened and who was responsible, and to provide justice for the victims and their families who suffered so terribly.
Yeah, let's just hope that Theresa May is not picking the judge herself. She has a bit of form, as I mentioned on her Facebook page today. She has a bit of form with picking ringers to head up inquiries. Let's hope she's not picking. So she said categorically that people won't have to leave if they don't want to. Yet folks have been telling reporters, journalists, that they've been threatened with being labelled intentionally homeless if they didn't take accommodation outside the area. So we'll see. Who's telling the truth? I don't know, we'll see. So back to the ultimate response to all of this. What's going to come out of all of this? Here is former Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith. Listen to him carefully. There's no doubt what's going on here.
Mr. Speaker, may I welcome the Prime Minister's statement and also welcome the actions that she said she's going to take and the government will take. Our hearts and prayers go out to all of those who have suffered so terribly and who will continue to suffer in the days that come. Can I, however, in the course of the public inquiry, ask her to add to the public inquiry one further remit, and that is to look at whether or not this whole process of retrofitting these old tower blocks is in fact viable at all, and whether or not there is a better way to both house and support tenants in these areas without the use of many of these incredibly badly designed and very faulty tower blocks. And could she ask the public inquiry to look carefully at whether or not it's feasible now for us to look at bringing some of these down and improving more family-friendly housing?
Yeah. You heard him, right? Let's bring them down. So what did May say?
Yeah. I'm grateful to my right honourable friend for his remarks. He's suggesting that the inquiry should in fact go a great deal further than looking into this particular instance. I think what is important, and we will ensure that the survivors and local residents have an input to the terms of reference for this inquiry to make sure that it is an inquiry that they can have confidence in and that they know will produce the results that they need and the justice that they need. I think we need to ensure, I will reflect on my right honourable friend's comments, but I think it's important primarily that the local residents feel confidence in the terms of reference in the inquiry and that it will get to the truth as they need it.
I don't think we'll get to the truth, sadly. Tear them down, said Duncan Smith. Now listen to what Duncan Smith didn't say. What did he not say? He didn't say Prime Minister, why don't we tear them down and build the exact same amount of apartments and reserve them exclusively for the families that were there already? Low-income families. He didn't say that, did he, Ian Duncan Smith? You know why? Because he's another sick Nazi bastard. That's what he is. Anybody with any humanity wouldn't talk about tearing down the places where people live without saying, as a caveat, by the way, let's build the exact same amount of apartments and reserve them exclusively at the same monthly rent agreements for those families who were there already. He didn't say that, did he, Duncan Smith? Did he? And you know why he didn't say that? Because I'm sure he knows a man who will build luxury properties there and sell them for £5 million apiece. The levels of sickness and evil in and around these people is beyond the scope and the comprehension of most people. It really is. Sickening, sickening people. And I'm genuinely angry. I don't fake this stuff. You know, not that it matters what I think. I'm not important, but it makes me sick to my stomach. Tear down the places where people live, where they've grown up, where their roots are. Don't mention what's going to happen to those people when that happens. Harriet Harman then, Labour. Don't start me. I know who she is, and I know all about the paedophile information exchange. Don't bombard me with emails. Harriet Harman had this to say to Theresa May. Listen carefully to what she says and May's response, which is vital.
She said that the Lackanell House coroner's... Well, she said the Lackanell House coroner's inquest findings had been acted on, but I would tell her that they have not. The coroner in 2013 in Lackanell House said that those deaths were avoidable, that there should have been sprinklers, that there should have been change in the fire instructions, that there should be greater supervision of contracts and fire inspection. She said that it was an unimaginable tragedy and that those deaths were should not have happened. They would not have happened if the government had acted on the Lackanell coroner's inquest rulings. Will she?
Thank you very much. Prime Minister.
Can I say to the Right Honourable Lady, first of all, to clarify what I said in my statement. What I said in my statement was that local authorities had been invited to send in samples of cladding from similar buildings. They had done those, and some of those samples had been found to be combustible. It was in relation to that testing that I used the term combustible. I think it's important that that I do that, because we had taken, as the Right Honourable Lady has suggested, we had taken the precautionary measure immediately of asking local authorities, all local authorities, to go out there to identify blocks with similar cladding and to take measures together with their local fire and rescue services to ensure that people within those buildings were safe. Part of that process has been about the testing. As I say, we stand ready to continue to test for all local authorities who wish to send samples in.
Right. OK, fair enough. Now listen to what May says next. This is crucial. And when you hear what she says, I want you to think about The Guardian, The Independent, The Times, The Mirror, The Sun, The Daily Mail. And I want you to think about all the other MPs who are present when she says what she's going to say now. Listen carefully.
Samples in. The description of the coroner's report from Lackanell House, the coroner did not, as I understand it, say that there should be sprinklers in every one of these types of properties.
She said that the Lackanell House coroner...
Yeah, you see, let me just bring us back there. I'm going to repeat that. Listen to this again.
...been about the testing. As I say, we stand ready to continue to test for all local authorities who wish to send samples in.
Right, here we go. Listen.
The description of the coroner's report from Lackanell House, the coroner did not, as I understand it, say that there should be sprinklers in every of one of these types of properties.
What a liar. What a pathological liar, and a disgrace to her office and to her profession. Liar, liar, know her name, Theresa May, knowingly lying to the House of Commons, lying to the nation, again, again, and again, and again. The coroner in the 10-week Lackanell House fire inquest was a guy called In fact, was a woman called Judge Frances Kirkham. Judge Frances Kirkham oversaw the Lakenal House fire inquest. And what did Judge Frances Kirkham write in a letter to the Community Secretary Eric Pickles at the time in 2013? What did Judge Frances Kirkham write? She wrote to him, and she copied in the Southwark and London Fire Brigade, and she made a series of recommendations. And one of the recommendations was clearly that landlords retrofit those buildings, buildings like Lakenal House, tower blocks with sprinklers. Lawyer Theresa May damned by lies. And Pickles ignored it, Eric Pickles, because Pickles and May and everybody else who sits in Westminster, all the whore masters and whore mistresses, are owned lock, stock and barrel by the billionaires who want to take over those buildings. What did Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott and Tom Watson and their ilk do across the floor? They sat on their hands while Theresa May told a whopper of a lie. A massive lie. It's not a small lie. It's not a slip of the tongue. It's not about an interpretation of what Judge Frances Kirkham wrote. It's not about her interpreting it one way or another. She said Kirkham did not recommend that the buildings be retrofitted with sprinklers. Kirkham recommended that very thing. This is the level. This is what you're dealing with, you see. And that's why I mentioned The Guardian, The Independent, BBC, Sky. None of them, even though their producers and political editors would have picked up on that, would have heard that and would have known straight away, red flag would have went up. Jesus, that's a lie. No, they've not reported it. The only media organisation in the United Kingdom this evening reporting on this, tragically, is The Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. It's disgusting. It's exactly 22 minutes past the hour. Do you want a bit of light relief? Do you want a bit of light relief just for a change? I was on davidicke.com headlines this morning and I saw a link to a story about Boris Johnson. Now, after the Queen's speech, senior politicians, senior cabinet ministers, they were all wheeled out on national television and radio to put some details on the government's programme. The programme which the Queen had read aloud at Westminster Palace. The Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, Bojo the Clown, went on Radio 4's PM show, presented by Eddie Mayer. Johnson struggled very badly with the questions put to him by Mayer. The questions were about the measures the speech contained to tackle the burning injustices identified by Theresa May. So Mayer was basically saying, tell us about these measures that will tackle the burning injustices identified by Theresa May. My friend, feast your ears.
What does this Queen's speech do to make sure the criminal justice system stops treating black people more harshly than white?
Well, there are measures in the, the bill on the courts, which I think is supposed to address some of those issues. And I think one thing in particular that we are looking at is measures to hang on a second. There are all sorts of measures that we want to take to ensure that we do not discriminate against everybody. And I think you'll find that the Prime Minister has been strong on that in her response, particularly to the attack in Finsbury.
Well, let me help you a little. She's talked about a race disparity unit, an audit, right, which we publish later this year. It's going to highlight differences in outcomes in every area, including criminal justice, but offers no solutions to the burning injustice that she highlighted. I want to ask you about another burning injustice. What does this Queen's speech do to help white working class boys go to university?
Well, one of the things that we want to see is good schools for everybody and greater investment in our schools. And so I think perhaps the most important thing that the Queen's speech does is continue to have to support economic growth for this country.
So I can tell you that in this speech and in the Downing Street briefing notes,
invest in our education.
The working class aren't mentioned in neither university.
Can I just make my point? The objective of the Queen's speech, there are three objectives. The first is to make sure that we have a a good Brexit, a successful Brexit.
I'm asking you about getting Brexit. White working the class boys to university.
And if you'll forgive me, I'm coming to that point. What we want to see is
this is beyond car crash. This right beyond car crash.
With better schools and to make sure that we increase the we make sure there's a ladder of opportunity for everybody. So what we will do is support schools, in particular academies, already being sponsored and supported by universities, as you know. It's a great part of their outreach work, and access to higher education for all sectors of the community, particularly white working class boys, is one of their priorities.
Right, so, let me turn to another branding injustice that she highlighted. What does this Queen's speech do to improve mental health care?
Well, what we want to see on mental health care is a proper understanding, and there indeed I think you'll find to get back to your first question.
Well, why don't we do the questions in the order I'm asking them? It's not a too Ronnie sketch. You can't answer the question before last.
I laughed so hard at that today that I was in tears. It's not a too Ronnie sketch. Let's not answer the question before the last one. Dreadful stuff, and more sinister than it sounds. I was particularly surprised. I mentioned this to a friend of mine today who I was speaking to about that sketch, because it is a sketch. I was surprised that anybody would allow Boris Johnson anywhere near Eddie Mayer, or allow Johnson to be interviewed by Eddie Mayer again. Because back in 2013, the BBC ran a documentary on BBC Two called The Irresistible Rise, which was all about Boris Johnson's meteoric rise in the Conservative Party. And I'm going to play you a little bit of that interview with Mayer. Just to remind you, the reason I'm playing it is that Boris Johnson isn't a lovable, bumbling fool as he cleverly portrays himself. You know, and after yesterday's interview, people will sadly love him even more. That two Ronnies thing, it's gone viral, it's hilarious. Boris is hilarious, isn't he? No, he isn't. This is Boris back in 2013 being grilled by Eddie Mayer on the Andrew Marr show. This is the real Boris Johnson. Have a listen to this.
Yeah, yeah. The programme also includes, well, this is about your integrity.
Okay.
The programme includes your reaction as you listen to a phone call in which your friend Darius Guppy asks you to supply the address of a journalist,
yes,
so that he can have him physically assaulted. The words beaten up and broken ribs are said to,
yes,
you. And you, having heard that, you tell your friend Darius Guppy you will supply the address. What does that say about you, Boris Johnson?
Well,
aren't you, in fact, making up quotes, lying to your party leader, wanting to be part of someone being physically assaulted? You're a nasty piece of work, aren't you?
Well, Eddie, I think all three things I would dispute.
Well, you don't factually dispute them.
Well, I do, and I could, you know, if we had a long time, which we don't, I could explain that I think all three interpretations you're putting on those things aren't wholly fair.
Nasty piece of work, said Eddie Mayer to Boris Johnson, who told a man who wanted the address of a journalist so that he could have him beaten to a pulp. Johnson told him, I'll get you the address, don't worry about it. Later he can claim that he was appeasing the man to calm him down. I wonder about that, though. I wonder about it. I really do wonder about it. And that dreadful performance on the Eddie Mayer Radio 4 show yesterday, which people will laugh at and say, oh, Boris is great, he's eccentric. What it should demonstrate to people is these hand-picked, corporate-owned whores like Boris Johnson don't know anything about the policies they talk about because they don't write them. They are way down the food chain in terms of who decides what policy is going to be. And this is what people need to get their heads around. And it's why people need to get their heads out of the sand regarding elections. Regarding, you know, oh, this time I'm going to vote this guy. I'm going to vote him. It's going to be great. He's the man. No, he's not. Dreadful stuff. Dreadful. And finally, for now, a story that probably will get lost in everything that's going on about the negotiations to leave the European Union, in the dreadful, dreadful, dreadful horror that is the Grenfell fire. What's going to get lost is a story today about Peter Ball, who Peter Ball was jailed for nearly 3 years back in 2015 because he admitted sex offences against 18 teenagers and young men. Who's Peter Ball, you might ask? Well, he's the former Bishop of Lewis, and also he was a former Bishop of Gloucester, and he carried out these disgusting crimes between the 1970s and 1990s. Why is it relevant today? He's in jail, and he's been in jail now for nearly 2 years. Well, it's relevant today because an independent review has found that senior figures in the Church of England colluded with Peter Ball and helped him evade detection. Which means what? Which means they condemned other boys who would later on be abused by Peter Ball because they didn't do the right thing, knowing that he was an abuser of children. And this review was chaired by Dame Moira Gibbs, and she heavily criticises the ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Carey, who has accepted the criticism and apologised to Ball's victims. I bet they're really pleased to hear that Lord Carey received letters from families telling him about the abuses carried out by Peter Ball. But Carey didn't pass those letters to the police. Eh? The Archbishop of Canterbury, eh? He also didn't put Ball on what's known as the Lambeth List, which is a list where clergymen, you know, if there are questions about your suitability as a minister, you go on this particular list. But Ball didn't go on that list at all. In fact, he was given funds to support him by Lord Carey. Anybody thinking that Lord Carey should be arrested and charged with perversion of justice by the police? Anybody? Is it just me? Eh? Wow. I believed him to be innocent, he said. Yes, you did. Like Joseph Ratzinger, who went on to become Pope Benedict XVI, knew that children were being raped, buggered, destroyed by priests in Ireland, and Ratzinger, long before he became Pope, wrote to Irish cardinals saying, "Do not hand these guys over to the police. It's best you move them on to another parish." And people have no idea about the scale of child abuse. It's, again, I mentioned earlier on about being beyond the scope of people. It's way beyond the scope of most people. That's it for the moment. In terms of the news roundup, I've just heard from David Shaler. David is going to be with me in a couple of minutes' time. This is your Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 and TuneIn Radio as well. I'll be back with you in about 60 seconds.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Richie Allen.
Welcome back to the programme. It's exactly 26 minutes to the top of the hour, Thursday, 22nd of June, 2017. David Shaler joins me in a couple of minutes' time. Thank you for your tweets on this. Apparently, Ian Duncan Smith will fill in for Jeremy Vine on BBC Radio 2 next week. Vine presents a topical talk show with music, interspersed pieces of music between taking phone calls. Weekdays, apparently Ed Miliband did. In fact, I know Ed Miliband did it. Ian Duncan Smith is going to be doing it next week. What in the name of Christ is the BBC coming to? Putting politicians on the air. We have this on LBC, don't we? Nigel Farage presenting programmes? Is this the way it's going to go now? Is this the way the Orwellian superstate is moving? We're going to have politicians presenting our fucking radio programmes? Is that the way it's going to be? Eh? Can't they find talent? Thousands of kids are coming out of universities all over the country every year from Salford and elsewhere, from drama schools, from broadcasting courses, and are sticking Ian fucking Nazi Hitler Duncan Smith on the radio next week on BBC Radio 2. Is that why people pay their licence fee? For fucking Nazis to present radio programmes. A man who laughed his arse off when George Osborne was announcing to the Commons and to the world that he planned to nail disabled people into their fucking coffins. And he sat there laughing away, falling around the place, laughing and pointing and jeering and yee-haw. And he's on BBC Radio 2 next week, is he? I tell you what that is. That's just fucking peachy, that. That's peachy. Back in a couple of minutes with David Shaler on your Richie Allen show on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 and TuneIn Radio. My name is Richie Allen and I'm no Nazi. We take care of our own on the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2. Check out fabradiointernational.com. It is exactly 21, is it 21 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Thanks for tuning into the programme. Thursday, June 22nd, 2017. Our next guest was on the programme last back in January. It's been a while. It's about time he came back on again. He is a terrific blogger, journalist. Of course, we know him most famously as having gone on the run from MI5. He blew the whistle on malfeasance, on very bad things while he was at MI5, Iraq and everything else, and spying on politicians. Let's just welcome him back to the programme. You can follow him on Twitter. He's at gods_spy. His website is davidshaler.com. Welcome back to our friend David Shaler. David, welcome back.
Thanks, Richie. Good to be back.
Nice to have you back on the show, mate. It's been a while. Good to have you on. You've been pretty busy. A lot going on. In fact, since you were on the programme last, we've had a number of very serious incidents in the country. Four terrorist attacks. The most recent, of course, being last week at Finsbury Mosque. And we're going to start off this evening, aren't we, talking about the attack at the Manchester Arena, which was carried out by Salman Abedi, allegedly. I say allegedly because that's what we've been told. We do know, though, that 22 people died and a lot of people were injured. And you've uncovered information about him and his father, and it's information that's not yet in the public domain, David. Do you want to talk a little bit about that as a way of beginning before we move on to other things? We'll cover a lot in the next hour or so. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is exclusive, Richie, at the moment. But it transpired when Salman Abedi, when this all came up, it turned out that his father, Ramadan Abedi, was arrested in Libya, and he's a member of what's known as the Islamic Fighting Group. Now, this man is also the agent Tunworth, who was essentially the Al-Qaeda in Libya member, or the Islamic Fighting Front member, who approached MI6 to get the money to fund the operation. Obviously, he didn't actually take part in the operation, because otherwise he probably would have been killed. But clearly, this is the go-between. Now, this operation in Manchester, the bomb was said to be of a very sophisticated design. So we have an MI6 agent is the father of the suicide bomber, according to their story, basically. So the expertise he would have learned from MI6, according to their logic, would have been used in that attack. So MI6 is implicated in this very clearly. I'm not saying they ordered the attack or anything like that. I'm saying the expertise they have given helped that attack go ahead, if we believe what they're saying, basically.
Agent Tunworth.
It gets worse, because when you look at the whole Abedi thing, him and another three guys from Manchester, who became known as the Manchester Taliban, in the noughties were travelling to Libya more or less at will. Now, these people are Islamic terrorists going over to Libya, and they seem to be able to go in and out of Britain with no problem at all. And each time they're going over, their aim is to try and assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. Now, to me, this is evidence that MI6 is working to the Zionist agenda. The Zionists have never liked Gaddafi, supported Abu Nidal, who carry out terrorism in the carry out resistance in the West Bank and so on, the Gaza Strip. So the Zionists never liked him. He funded the IRA. These are resistance movements. In my mind, there were people who were opposing occupation in the only way they could, because the law had failed them. Obviously, the Zionist viewpoint, this was made Gaddafi public enemy number one at one point. And it's absolutely clear, the more he tried to create rapprochement with the West, the more desperate MI6 were to have him assassinated. And I say, the operation I blew the whistle on in 96 made absolutely no sense, because by 1996, Gaddafi had given up terrorism, and yet we were funding this new group of people who MI5 knew even then were the new threat to the West, basically. So this is all the proof you need. I can show you other stuff. I'm going to be putting stuff up on the internet. There are documents that appeared in the past. There's another example of MI5 letting a Libyan terrorist into the country in the mid-1990s. Now, MI6 said they could recruit him. They got nowhere. This guy set up a terrorist network. And the document that appeared on the internet, you can see in that paragraph where MI5 actually have to admit that. They admit to government that by letting this in, he set up this terrorist network. So I was obviously involved in trying to expel him, basically. And in the end, we got an expulsion order against him and he had to leave. That combined with the idea that they allowed tens of thousands of Islamic terrorists into the UK, knowing they were terrorists. These weren't people who slipped in the mid-1990s. They knew these people were veterans of the Afghan-Soviet war, were therefore Mujahideen, were therefore Islamic extremists. But nevertheless, they let them settle in Britain. And this, obviously, is the background to what is going on now. Everything seems to have come full circle. In August, it'll be 20 years since I first blew the whistle, basically. So it's quite incredible that we've now come back to the idea of Tunworth again. Now, I've made this information about Ramadan Abedi, Tunworth, available to the Prime Minister. I emailed Number 10 using their official thing. I also sent it to the head of the Met, and I sent it to Jeremy Corbyn. Not one of them has got back to me.
Basically. Nobody's gotten back to you yet, David. Nobody.
Nobody.
When did you send the info? In the last couple of days, was it?
No, about a couple of weeks ago.
Jesus Christ. So in 2 weeks, nobody has said anything. Let's just go over this again. This is vital. So the Manchester bomber was named as Salman Abedi. Yeah. Apparently, he was 22 years old. This happened on the 22nd. 22 people were killed. A lot of people make a lot out of that. We might talk about that, we might not. One of the things that we get asked all the time, did it happen? Was it a hoax? And all of this sort of nonsense. I know people who treated the injured and who dealt with the horrible cleanup afterwards. And I believe those people. This was a terrible thing. People were killed. So his father was Agent Tunworth, basically. He was an asset of MI6, and he was used to basically undermine the Gaddafi regime, if you want to call it that, or government in Libya. Give our listeners, David, an idea of the timeline. A lot of people won't understand this. Give us the timeline.
This was in the mid-1990s. Posted to the Libyan desk, and I have very good relations with MI6. That's why I was briefed on this operation. And obviously, this is one of the reasons why I left the service. Up to that point, I could still, in my conscience, say that I was trying to stop terrorism, as I saw it at the time. But this suddenly was me being party to a terrorist operation in which innocent people had died. Now, certain British commentators said that those deaths in the attempt on Gaddafi's life were merely collateral damage. Now, I think Manchester has put that into perspective. If anybody were to say what happened in Manchester to those young girls was merely collateral damage in some ongoing terrorist war, they would be drummed out of town, and quite deservedly so. Now, obviously, Libyan people aren't as close to us, but they are human beings. I was an atheist at the time. I believe so much in the sanctity of human life. That is why I blew the whistle. But let's think, Richie, what does this reveal about the country? 20 years ago, I blew the whistle on our intelligence operatives deciding foreign policy, because the Foreign Secretary of the day, Malcolm Rifkin, did not give permission for this, had no idea about it. So they're going off deciding the power of life and death over people like Gaddafi, and obviously in the case of the attack in 96, which went wrong, the lives of innocent people, bystanders who were in the crowd meeting Gaddafi in the same way we have a meet and greet with the Prime Minister in this country. These people are innocent civilians. And as I said at the time, you remove Gaddafi, you remove the stability of Libya and possibly North Africa. That's all now come to pass in 2011.
And you believe, don't you, my friend, you believe that the chaos that follows the removal of these people was the plan all along, right?
Absolutely. It's always been the plan, yeah, absolutely. Wherever they can, they will try and replace what were essentially more moderate governments, certainly by the standards of the region, people like Saddam and Gaddafi and so on, in the case of Assad now in Syria. These are the more westernized, the more outward-looking, mostly Islamic countries. But they were also pluralist countries as well. They weren't just purely Islamic countries. And what we've now replaced that with, obviously, is these extreme Islamic governments. And that's why we have attacks like in Manchester. You say it appears to be a real attack. How far that Salman Abedi's involved, I think it's impossible to say at this stage. They found a bank card in his pocket, supposedly, which is a kind of thing that we look for in what we might be a false flag operation. Not in terms of it not happening,
yeah.
It obviously happened, but in terms of trying to blame somebody else for it, basically.
Somebody who mightn't have done it, yeah. David Shaler is on the line, folks. This is, I don't want to be, punning my way through the programme, but this is explosive. This is explosive stuff, this. I want to talk, just before we come back to, because some people will say, and they will, and I'm not trying to be the devil's advocate, but some people will say, well, look, this is what these dirty intelligence agencies do. They use people, they have their assets abroad, and, it might be the case, so his son was radicalized. That was a coincidence. People will say that, David. You know that. They will say, that's just the way it happens to be. He came from the region, whatever, whatever. We'll come back to that in a minute. I want you to talk about thousands of radicals coming into the country in the 90s. Now, we're talking about people who would follow a Wahhabi Salafist, philosophy of Islam, right?
Extreme of Islam.
Exactly. Now, all I'm saying, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. You're going to think I'm an idiot. I'm not. I'm imagining there are listeners listening who don't know this stuff. This is basic stuff for you and for me. How did they get into the country? Who were these people? Where were they coming from in the 90s?
They were generally, coming over from Afghanistan. And there were some other places as well. I can't quite remember, but yeah. They were veterans, of the Soviet-Afghan War. And they were let in for that reason, on the logic that my enemy's enemy is my friend, which is a very, very false logic, as we have seen time and time again in history, basically.
Yeah.
But what that obviously enabled was people with combat experience, with guerrilla warfare experience, bomb making, snipers, have all come out of the country with that expertise. And even if those people themselves were not actually involved, they're in position to be able to obviously train others. And, you know, and obviously, again, with this reaction, I can't stress this enough. Whenever what they call terrorism, which is in fact resistance, occurs, it occurs where a people are utterly, utterly oppressed and denied the very rule of law, basically. That we're talking about Catholics in Northern Ireland in the late 60s. You had Protestants going in their homes and shooting them, for God's sake. And the IUC did nothing about it, or in some cases joined in. Now, in those circumstances, when the local police are involved in attacking you, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
Other than band together and pick up a weapon and defend yourself. The same can be said of Palestine. The same can be said, I say, of a lot of areas where they're saying these people are terrorists. They're not at all. The terrorists on this planet are so obviously mainly Israel, UK and US, but they've obviously dragged a whole lot more people into it, including other European governments and Saudi Arabia.
Let me ask you this, my friend. Those thousands of men who came into the country in the 1990s, who had a different view of Islam, the Wahhabi, very extreme view, can it be argued that the mischief makers, the shadowy elites behind the scenes, they wanted them to come in because they wanted chaos to reign further down the road, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all part of the plan. I mean, I think what actually happened was when they collapsed the former Sov bloc, the Eastern Europe and the communist countries, I think what their plan was to roll that out over a number of years. But things don't always go to plan for them. And I think what happened was when a few people saw this in the Eastern Bloc, they all revolted very quickly. So in terms of the world geopolitics, you've got this vacuum between the collapse of the Sov bloc and the Eastern Bloc countries and the rise of a new threat. In fact, the mid-1990s, defence spending in the US was cut for the first time since the Second World War, basically. You had a peace process in the Middle East, you had a peace process in Northern Ireland. It was all going very, very well. And obviously what we now look at is the Zionists thinking, well, no, we've now got to try and roll out our new form of terrorism and so on. We've been feeding these people like these Islamic extremists into the UK, but hey, we need to trigger it with something else. Hence, hey, let's go for Gaddafi, get rid of Gaddafi, create chaos in North Africa, take it from there, basically.
This is incredible stuff. David Shaler is on the line, folks. He's a lot more than just a former MI5 officer, agent, a lot more besides. DavidShaler.com @gods_spy on Twitter. Was the Lockerbie bomb, which I remember I was a child, David. When I say I was a child, I would have been early teens, I suppose. And I'll never forget it. In Ireland, it got the blanket media coverage it got everywhere else. Was that an MI6, joint MI6 CIA operation to, to blame Gaddafi, was it?
No, it wasn't actually. I mean, I looked at this in some detail because I was the Libyan desk officer. Now, when Lockerbie actually happened, I was actually a journalist. By the time 1994, I'm an intelligence officer posted to the Libyan desk with responsibility for Lockerbie. So I have what is a conspiracy theorist wet dream. I can look at all the MI5 files. So I do. I go through them all with a fine tooth comb, basically. And what transpired is those conspiracy theories seeking to blame either Iran or Syria or Iranian-backed groups were coming out of MI6. I also found that MI6 got a specific section called Information Operations, whose job it is to plant up stories that they say are favourable to the UK, but obviously are designed generally to discredit the enemies of MI6, basically. And I've been victim to that. David Icke's been victim of that. Anybody who stands up to these people will be a victim of that. Even Stella Rimmington, when she brought her book out, got the briefings and the attacks and so on. So I say, as soon as you step out of line, they have all these people in place in the media and so on. Now, again, this is unbelievable that MPs won't take my evidence in this area.
It's incredible.
People won't listen to this. I mean, today I also tweeted the Daily Mail telling them that this story was theirs if they wanted it. And they didn't respond either, basically.
And you've given them, I mean, the documentation you have that you will publish on your website, it clearly shows and demonstrates that Ramadan al-Abadi, was that his name, his father?
Yeah, his name's actually redacted from that document. But if you were to remove the redaction, I can tell you with a 99% degree of certainty that that is Ramadan al-Abadi, basically.
And MI6 knew him as Agent Tunworth.
That's right, yeah, that was his code name, basically.
Christ almighty.
And so they I say, it's all incredible how it's come full circle.
Yeah, and they want us to believe that it was his son, acting on his own, was able to put together a very sophisticated bomb, evade security, Look, I can understand evading security. I was, because it's been closed ever since. I was a frequent visitor to the Manchester Arena, and security has always been lax there. That's not to criticise the men and women who work for ShowSec, which is the firm that does the security. But when you go to the actual gate with your ticket at the arena, of course it's going to bloody well change now, but until the attack, because we were at a take that gig only 3 days before it, don't laugh at me, we were there, and you walk up and they had a cursory look at Caroline's handbag and they did not search my coat. I was wearing a coat. They did not. They just passed us inside. You know, so anybody could have, I could have been wearing a belt and walked in there and blown myself to pieces, and that would have been the end of anybody around me. But what an extraordinary thing for MI6 to say they knew this guy. MI5 said, we knew this guy. He'd been to Syria. We knew he'd had contact with ISIS. It stinks. I mean, this is a massive scandal, David. And you're giving this to the politicians and to the national newspapers, and they don't want to know.
Well, it seems that with these current wave of attacks, these people are actually known to the intelligence services, but the intelligence services don't act against them. Now, you know, I'm not going to criticise them for that necessarily, because we don't know the detail or the reliability of the information they were in possession of. It's very easy to talk with hindsight. So when you're doing an intelligence investigation, it's like doing a 1,000-piece jigsaw, and you've got about 30% of the pieces and no picture on the box. You know, it's a lot of it is semi-informed guessing, basically. So I'm not going to criticise them for that, but for the active MI6 support of Tunworth, that clearly gave them expertise, the fact they were sponsoring him and these other Manchester Taliban to try and assassinate Gaddafi, appointment Gaddafi, I say, has renounced terrorism and is looking for a rapprochement with the West, basically.
Yeah.
This is how sick the whole thing is. It's like this ridiculous kind of middle-class boys' game, although they're now obviously very ably supported by a number of middle-class women as well, basically doing all of this. And I say it has no respect for human life. It seems that they have to take these people and send them to public schools and turn them into psychopaths. That's the problem with our MPs. Something like about 35% of our MPs went to public school. A lot of them would have boarded and so on. That's not a normal life. You don't form normal family relationships. You don't form normal friendships where you go home at the end of the day. What you form are power alliances. So they use that as a way of training up the political class. When I say that, I'm including the intelligence services, the media, the judiciary, and so on, basically, to essentially be psychopaths to do their bidding. And I was thinking about it again the other day. Every so often I just go back to it and just think about Blair's incredible attempt to justify the invasion of Iraq and just seeing the empty eyes of a self-justifying psychopath, a man who has no empathy for what he's actually done, for the suffering that he's caused other human beings. And I say people can have a go at me about all sorts of stuff, but I will tell you now, I have not caused harm to anybody in this process. And obviously I have been tempted. When the member of Libyan intelligence comes to you and you've just got out the nick and you're put in that nick for trying to expose this story, or in fact tell the government about it, and he offers you millions, name your price, obviously, in those moments, he's done his research. That's when you try and pitch somebody, is when they've got a reason for them to be pissed off at their own government. And obviously, in my circumstances, that was a very tempting offer. But I'd said no, because obviously, any information I gave to them would be used to kill people,
harm people, for
the British in Libya. And obviously, that's never why I did this. But at times, the other side were trying to provoke me into doing that, because they don't give a stuff about any of that stuff. I say to them, we're just pawns. They were definitely at points trying to provoke me into naming officers on the internet and stuff like that. But I didn't do that. And I say even, and again, Richie, I don't know whether I can't, whether I've mentioned this in public, but I put that MI6 document on the internet in 1999. It's a strange story how I got hold of it again. But I was the one that redacted it. That's why I can tell you it's ran with a baby on it, basically. And that document, I say, appeared after a foreign secretary had said, this is pure fantasy with no basis in fact. Now, when people hear that, they think, God, Shaler must be the biggest fantasist in the world. God, there's no basis in fact. This is making up stuff to embarrass the services. Now, obviously, when that document then appears on the internet, It actually shows that MI6 did have a relationship with this coup plotter. The document makes it clear he's involved. It obviously doesn't mention the payments have been made. It's not that sort of document. But it mentions the attack before it happens and crucially, therefore, predicts what's going to happen. It's not somebody trying to impress somebody by seeing an attack and then saying, oh, it was them. The fact that their modus operandi is delivered before in this report, before the actual attack happens, shows it's them when it happens, basically. So this is absolutely incontrovertible on all levels. We have a foreign secretary who lied to cover up on behalf of murderers in MI6. And yet nobody in the mainstream media seems to think there's anything wrong with that.
No.
Now, I say, this is where we are in this. And obviously, Richard, I can just shift the focus a little bit. And we talk about a lot of stuff like this security, but with my other hat on, the spiritual hat on, that is what is going on at the moment. I've said that this year was going to be a spectacular year one way or the other, and I don't think anybody can dispute that. We have been shaken to our foundations in some ways. But that, to me, is because we've lost touch with the essential true law, the law of love your neighbours, you love yourself. We're obsessed with rules. And rules are just there for psychopaths, basically. Psychopaths can follow a rule that causes all sorts of harm to a human being and say, oh, well, not my problem, mate. I'm just following the rule kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Can I, before we segue into that, right, because this is very important as well, we accept, do we, that the intelligence services might have known that Salman Abedi was about to pull the trigger and kill people, and for reasons of certain gains that they could make from that legislation they could bring in, the encroaching police state they want to bring in, they knew Abedi was going to do it and yet turned a blind eye and left him do it. Is that a strong possibility?
Again, yeah, we could go through different theories. I mean, even the fact to say it's not beyond the information we have to reasonably conclude that MI6 may have been somehow fanning this whole thing. Or even beyond that, if we go into the real deep state, that someone somewhere who is very, very powerful is setting up MI6. That's the one thing I just can't get out of my head. Sometimes with these things, I look at them and I just get this boom. A bit like with the Gareth Williams, the spy in the bag case, where the first thing I thought was, this is somebody showing MI6. They can't protect one of their operatives in their own safe house. Yeah. That's got to be somebody who is very, very powerful, basically. So it's almost like somebody behind the scenes is setting up MI6. And I've always postulated the idea that there is a good secret society there. People use the term Illuminati in the wrong way. We've certainly had recently the Illuminati declaring over the last couple of years, saying that we're not the Illuminati described. That's the Zionist old world order. We're going to bring in a new order of consciousness truly based on love. Illuminati means enlightened ones. You know, get fed up of those kind of internet sites. It's the Illuminati, man. And it's just like the most clueless people who come up with the most visible conspiracy theories always call these people the Illuminati. And usually because they say they're doing it on behalf of the other side.
Absolutely.
One of the clues of these things, basically, is if they don't mention the word Zionist, you can be pretty sure they're a Zionist stooge at some level.
Right, let me take a very quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to you about Zionism. I'm going to ask you to explain it as you understand it. And I also want to ask you a very serious question that's been coming in from listeners who were listening to a phone-in show I did the other day, and they want me to talk to you about the extent of radical Islam here, this idea of sleeper cells, the offspring maybe of those Wahhabi radicals who came into the country. Stay with us, David. David Shaler is on the line, folks. This is very important stuff. It's 3 minutes past the hour for Thursday, June 22nd, 2017. Back with more from David Shaler. Go to davidshaler.com after this, very quickly.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbayerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device. Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is The Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com.
And my guest this Thursday is David Shaler, former MI5 officer, journalist, author, spiritualist. David, thanks for staying with me. We have two types of people in this country. I talk a lot about identity politics, David, and my dot is the only dot. So we have the Tommy Robinsons. All Muslims who believe the Quran or who read the Quran, they're all dangerous, they're all trying to establish a caliphate, and they're all pretty much evil. On the other hand, I believe we have the what I call the lunatic left, who tell you there's no problem at all, we all got to love one another, leave the Muslims alone, you are an Islamophobe, and you are racist if you ask any questions. Now, I've always believed, David, as a journalist, the truth is always somewhere different. I obviously believe, because it's been my experience, the vast majority of people who adhere to or subscribe to any religion, no matter which one it is, Judaism, Christianity, whatever, Islam, whatever, they're decent people, they pay their taxes, they want to get on with life, and they want to raise their families and so on. But I'm not an idiot. Things are not black and white. There are shades of grey. There are obviously some people who do subscribe to the Wahhabi Salafi view. How does that relate to the thousands of people who came into the country in the 1990s with those views? And with that in mind, what sort of genuine radical threat exists in this country, in your opinion?
Well, I think that the radical threat has, been created by denying the rule of law, hasn't it? I mean, obviously, the most glaring example we have is where Muslims are blamed for 9/11, when there's no evidence to show that at all. In fact, the only actual evidence we have of anybody being likely is, in fact, Israel. We know that there are reports that hundreds of Israeli operatives were rounded up. We know that we know about the dancing Israelis. We know about the Israelis rested on one of the bridges in New York that day. They've claimed they were following around these people. But actually, there's not much evidence of those people actually really existing. And when we consider that seven of them have claimed to be still alive, we started to realise that obviously the people we say were responsible for 9/11 were just a series of false identities, which could have obviously been used by those Israeli operatives. If they really were carrying out the surveillance, as they said, why didn't they pass more on to the FBI? Why didn't they make more efforts to stop those attacks? So you can kind of see why people of a particular mindset. And again, I mean, if I was a young Muslim lad, I can understand that if you're seeing this burning injustice against your people, you would feel a need to do something about that. That is the problem. I mean, you know, what I can't understand is when we have these programs, everybody just looks so bemused. Oh, Manchester's been bombed by an evil Islamic terrorist. We just can't understand why this is happening. And it's like I live in a parallel universe to them. What, you mean you don't remember the last 15 years of war, the white phosphorus, the depleted uranium, the refugee crisis you've created? You've destroyed these people's lives. And then you wonder why you get a bit of blowback, if that is indeed the case of what this is.
But yet the majority of Muslims in this country, the vast majority, like you and I, they're disgusted by UK, US, NATO foreign policy, the destruction that we've wrought on those countries, the murder. And yet the vast majority of men and women who go to the mosque wouldn't entertain the idea of taking up arms because they're peace-loving.
It's so, like all of us, isn't it, Richie?
Yeah.
So, see, during my case, obviously there are times you think this democratic system doesn't work.
Yeah.
Stuff people need to know. And you get tempted. You kind of start thinking, should I go down that route? But obviously you're a sane human being, you don't. Because so one of the reasons I blew the whistle was to stop people having to suffer bereavements and so on because of terrorist attacks. If I then go down the same route and start killing people, I'm just creating that problem.
Can I ask you a question on that, David? Because the point I was trying to make, and I know I'm not making it very well, and it's not because I'm trying to be politically correct. I sometimes struggle to really explain what it is I'm trying to get at. The Wahhabi Salafi ideology, which we know was created ultimately by the British government, by the British Army. We know this way, way back when. But that ideology exists, and that didn't come out of the dreadful things that happened in Iran, 1953, Mossadegh, everything else, the destruction of Iran in the early 1980s because of the Iran-Iraq war, when we gave Saddam all the weaponry and all the money he needed, all the terrible things we've done. But we can differentiate, we can separate away from that the Wahhabi ideology, which seems to be a misogynistic, hateful, kind of murdering ideology anyway on its own. And I'm trying to establish, and I can't establish, how serious is that? And is there a lot of that about? That's the question I'm trying to kind of get to the bottom of.
No, again, I don't think there's a lot of it about, but you don't need many of these people to create chaos, do you? So no. It's only extreme elements it will embed with. You've got to be a bit of a psychopath in the first place. What is more interesting about Wahhabi Islam, as I say, that violent Islam basically is a front for Zionism. We know that ISIS fighters have been treated by Israeli doctors. We know that ISIS has been funded by God knows who in Syria, basically. Yeah. Just about every Western government seems to have got their tuppence within it in somewhere at some point. So they are a front for Zionism. That's what you've got to see this thing. I found out today, apparently, Tommy Robinson's a Zionist. So he has no problem with what the State of Israel does to all those terrible, those people in Gaza, all the terrible injuries and shootings it inflicts on people, and it leaves a knife there afterwards. He's not bothered by any of that, of course.
No, because his dot is the only dot. He's just another Bill O'Reilly or Ann Coulter or Richard Littlejohn. He's just another extreme version of those people. My dot is the only dot. He did an interview with a friend of mine recently, and he was wearing an Israeli Defence Forces T-shirt. I was really glad it was my friend interviewing him, because I would have torn him apart for that. It's absolutely ludicrous. How do you define Zionism for people? Because we're at this stage. The Home Secretary today, Amber Rudd, and I didn't get a chance to play the audio because I ran out of time. And there's no way I'm eating into your time, mate. I'm delighted you're back on the programme. I wanted to play a clip earlier. She talked about plans to deal with the failure of the state to prevent Manchester and London. One of those plans is to become much, much harder on non-violent extremism. They want to become harder on people who access terror sites. Now, the parallel you can draw here is they're saying that going onto a terror website and reading terrorist propaganda is just as bad as if you're downloading or watching kiddie porn, which is ludicrous. But that's what they're saying. And they are suggesting that we punish much harder people who are reading terrorist material online. So this is really sinister. Now, the point I'm trying to make is, at some stage, people are going to say Zionism is... Basically, they're going to say that Zionism is as bad a word as nigger. That's what they're going to say. They're going to say it's a racist word by somebody who's too cowardly to blame the ills of the world on the Jewish people. Now, you and I know, of course, we differentiate between Zionism and Jews. Of course we do. But this is what they're going to do, David. This is the reaction to events like we saw in London and Manchester. We've got to deal with non-violent extremism. So when somebody says to you, hey, Shaler, how do you identify, how do you... Give me your definition for the term Zionism or Zionist. What do you say?
The first definition of Zionism is to do with the promised land from the Bible, land promised by God to Abraham and his descendants. And obviously, a lot of people in Israel, therefore, have claimed this, that is that land in Israel. And therefore, Zionism in the first instance is about the return to the Holy Land or the promised land. However, anybody who's read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and has had their eyes open for the last 20 years will know that Zionism is really about the subjugation of mankind. That wherever there's peace, they will create all sorts of violence and war and so on. But it's not just assault through war, it's assault through propaganda, it's through poisoning us. At the moment, this is where I say this is the spiritual mission, is because we are mankind's being assaulted from all sides. Now, Amber Rudd here, he's not going to solve the problem by clamping down on people who aren't actually involved in the terrorism. That will only, again, radicalise more Muslims. It's a bit like locking up Catholic people from Northern Ireland without trial. in the early 1970s. They thought that would solve the conflict, and it didn't, of course, because they locked up a load of innocent people who then did join the IRA and did subsequently become resistance fighters. So we had 30 years of conflict, basically.
And terrorists as well. They did some very bad things.
What frustrates me, Richie, so much is I've got this expertise. I know these things.
You know these things, yeah.
The modicum of understanding about things like terrorism and so on would know that that is the very worst thing you can do. But clearly, she's being briefed by Zionists who are trying to exacerbate this situation as far as possible. But also, of course, when you talk about non-violent extremists, you're starting then to encompass people like us, of course. To them, we're extremists. Even though what we're trying to do is ask questions and get the truth, in their mind, if you say 9/11 is an inside job or the world's run by bankers, you're an extremist, basically.
This is a brilliant point you're making, David, and this is why 2 years ago when Theresa May was the Home Secretary, she was interviewed by John Humphreys on Radio 4. It's a clip that went viral. It's on YouTube. I play it on the programme from time to time. And Humphreys did an excellent job of basically putting her into a corner and getting her to acknowledge that she wouldn't define nonviolent extremism because they want to basically call whatever they want to say is nonviolent extremism. This is why they won't give a definite and a definitive definition of what it is. They won't do that so that they can point at anybody. Oh, Shaler, Zionism, he's a nonviolent extremist. Ike talks about Zionism, nonviolent extremist. They won't define it, the bastards, because they know, because they want to be able to just throw that accusation at anybody, don't they?
Yeah, no, exactly. Saying it, and this is obviously part of the wider issue. That what I've got to tell people now as well is that the world economy is absolutely teetering. I mean, I know I came on last June and said it was going to teeter, but they printed 250 billion of new pounds basically as a result of Brexit. And that's propped the economy up for a few more months or a year or whatever. But we've come round to these cycles again. The major banks are massively over-leveraged. Their assets run into billions. Their liabilities run into trillions, basically. The whole thing, all savings, the financial thing, is meaningless. The reason they carry on running it on is they're still trying to take as much wealth off as possible.
Real wealth.
This is where people have got to realise, if you're living under a system in which the government doesn't even want to take evidence about the fact the intelligence services have been going around murdering people, or the fact that the economy is in this situation, or bankers have been deliberately manipulating things, or the fact that they took out Gaddafi in Saddam for economic reasons, nothing to do with terrorism, but for the fact they were going to start use various different currencies rather than the dollar, which would have then sent the dollar into free fall. All this stuff is economic. It all goes back to the banks. The countries that have been attacked are all countries that were not part of the Bank of International Settlements. And I say, this is so serious with these MPs. In 2013, we had a vote on Syria where we nearly went into the Third World War by accident. That's how crazy it is. So, I'm in this situation now. I'm just saying, please, for God's sake, listen to somebody with a bit of expertise and wisdom before you cause all sorts of other suffering. And obviously, I've got to say to people, given the times we are in, that I'm saying it for their own self-interest, because the karma that is going to come to these people is going to be absolutely enormous. God set this up, so he's been holding up the karma. So they've got two choices. Either they repent, which is great, I'm happy with that. Tony Blair comes up tomorrow, makes a full confession and everything else, doesn't do it again, I'm very happy with that. Or they get hit by the darkest karma, basically. And we are in this wider end times. The whole issue of Zionism, the return to the promised land, the other meaning of Zion is the flash or the signal, like the lightning flash. And hence they talk about Zion as the flash of creation, but also there will be another flash before we go essentially to a different state of being. That's what this is all about. There's never been a time like this in human history. There's never been a time when the rich have been so able to monitor and survey and use that to effectively rob us of all our money and take it to them. We've never had a transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich in this way.
Never. It's quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinary. I was talking to a friend of mine today, Michael, in South Manchester where I live. And we were talking about mortgages, and I was saying to him, you know, I've rented all my life, even though both myself and my fiance have worked all our life. And he said, we were talking about mortgages, and I said I couldn't afford a mortgage. I might be able to cobble together the bare bones of a deposit, between the two of us, probably, but maybe not. But I said I couldn't enter into a fraudulent agreement with a financial institution that doesn't ever intend for me to pay them back. They ultimately want to extort as much interest out of me as possible. They want me to default, and then they gain something. They gain a physical property that they never had to begin with. They lost and risked nothing. They have the property, and then they also cash in on the insurance policy they took out at the time that the mortgage was issued. And I said I would advise no young man or woman in this country to take out a mortgage with any financial institution. Such is the tyranny. I would not advise a kid, a young man or woman, unless they've got the money to go and buy a house and they've got the cash, do not enter into a mortgage agreement with a bank. What do you think?
Well, this is where my research comes in, because it shows that paying the mortgage is actually unlawful. There's also research from their system showing that the mortgage is not a contract. And if there's no contract, there's nothing to enforce, basically. So under the common law, under their law, the mortgage is not a contract, so you don't have to pay it. Under the common law, it's actually unlawful because it's based upon usury, and usury is forbidden by the true paramount and mandatory law. Anybody who doubts this is the paramount and mandatory law, I'd send to the bookofthelaw.org, or if they look up Law Shayla Amazon, they'll find my book, which goes into some detail about all of this. And this is what we've got to do in going forward. Any organisation can be manipulated. Now, obviously, at the moment, there's a bit of hope about Jeremy Corbyn. And I have to say, I kind of bought into that. I started watching the election campaign, thinking this might be quite, you know, just see what's going on. And he did actually inspire me. He was a man that actually seemed to speak from the heart and seemed to show some real spark and so on. But, of course, he can be easily manipulated. The Labour Party can be easily manipulated. So what we've got to do now is abandon that corporate protest and make your own stand. Don't pay your mortgage. Your house is yours. You live there, basically. Who else has a right to that house? No one. That's where you've got to think. And that, of course, hits them in the way they hit us. They always hit us in the pocket. I mean, I've spent the last 6 months trying to scrape a living together. I've been living in caravans. I've barely had places to live at times. I've been living outside, trying to, you know, promote my book, just get some money together, even buy some books to sell. They keep you right on the edge. They keep you on the poverty line. You don't get a moment of pause where you, I've been lucky recently, I've done a bit of work recently, had a few days of pause, but that's about the first time in 6 months, basically. So let's do that to them. Let's take away the source of their income, which is from usury, from banking and so on. If people were to do that, we'd change the system very, very quickly.
And they never loaned you any money to begin with. When they issued the loan, they haven't lent you anything.
But there's all sorts of reasons not to do this, all sorts of moral reasons and everything. In fact, it's a no-brainer.
But can I just say this, David, Listen, I'm with you. I've just tweeted a link, by the way, to your book, Law. I've tweeted a link to that there, folks. I'll tweet it again in a minute. Law by Dave Shaler. You know, it's well worth a read, it really is. Now, it really is. See, the problem with this is they come along with their eviction. They come along with the sheriff and the police, and they put you out, David. This is the problem.
Yeah, now, this is where we've got to get together as true activists, and if they do, we've got to not let them in, because they're not allowed in. Even the police, low safety, are not allowed in. If they haven't got a signed document, you don't have to open the door to anybody, so you've got to know your stuff like that. But also, you've got to get on Twitter, get phoning to your mates, send out text saying, look, I'm being hassled by these people. If we can get numbers here, we're going to be safe. So we police ourselves. We look after each other in that way. Because believe me, there's no, even if 10 people turn up, it's going to make it very, very difficult for them. And if 20 turn up, you know, it's impossible, basically, for the other side. So it doesn't need many people, folks in the right place at the right time, to be able to resist these possession orders. And then we go on the attack, and we start reporting these to the people, to the police, for harassment. We start issuing writs against them for harassment, the companies they work for. And then we go to those companies and do what they've done to poor grannies and stuff like that, and go into their place and start taking their stuff. But we'll have the force of law behind us, because we'll have a reason to take their stuff, because we'll have set up contracts and so on that they've breached. The self-serving contract where you say, you come round, I'm going to charge you £100,000. That's a contract under common law and under their law. So again, they've got nowhere to go. And you say, go to their business and start taking stuff and say, I'm sorry, I'm taking goods as restitution, basically. This is what we've got to do. I can't stand this liberal nonsense, all this feminist nonsense, all that crap. It's all been played out so often in my lifetime. It's got absolutely nowhere. It has no perspective on the world. It's just a load of very uninformed inexperienced middle-class kids thinking they're doing something good when they're not, basically. In fact, they're actually, they are the most manipulated people by the Zionists. The Zionists, obviously, people think, well, the banking industry might exploit me. I've got to be worried about the government. But the protocols leave you in no doubt. The liberals, the intellectuals get plenty of mentions in there as being, you know, the ones who are really going to do it for them, basically. And this, of course, is why the intellectuals, liberals, therefore say, oh, it's all anti-Semitic hoax. Don't read it. Because they know people are going to read it and go, hang on, it's fingering these liberals here. So I've seen nothing different on the internet. I've seen no solutions coming up from these people. I've just seen the usual hypocrisy. And it's Islamic terrorism. You've got to play it all down. A white man does it, though. You've got to play it all up, haven't you? That's the way they play things. It's, and I say, it's sick. I mean, these people, it's our political class has an adolescent approach to politics.
You're talking, yeah,
adolescent approach.
And you're talking, of course, about the imposition of the political correctness agenda on society, which has done such extraordinary damage in recent years in shutting down debate and in making people scared and embarrassed to say what it is they feel, even if it's wrong. I mean, you and I are of a certain age. There isn't anything wrong with being wrong. There's nothing wrong with having ideas about things, you know, if they happen to be wrong or right. There should be nothing wrong with saying them. You know, you can't say that. That might offend black people. That might offend Irish people, that might offend people from Newcastle upon Tyne. Well, it doesn't matter. You know, we have the right to be offended. We have the right to offend in equal measure. And of course, this has shut debate down. You can't talk about these things. We had a phone in the other night, and a young girl from Keighley in Yorkshire came on, and she was absolutely adamant and passionate about talking about, you know, what she saw as a negative Islamic ideology. Now, whether she's right or wrong, I thought she was passionate and I thought she had some ideas, but I thought fundamentally she's not understanding where the Islamic fundamentalism comes from, how it grew, where it came out of. You talked about it earlier on, Western foreign policy, the slaughter of millions of people overseas, and even still, the genuine radical ideologues, the Wahhabi supporters, are still the tiny, tiny, tiny minority. And yet we never talk about the neo-Nazis. We never talk about the football hooligans, the thugs who get together at weekends and kick people's heads in. You know, we just talk about Islamic ideologues. Political correctness is a terrible thing, and it's all creeping, David. And it's getting worse, isn't it?
It is, but there's always reactions against that. And I say, you really, the only way to deal with these people is to be as rude to them as possible, basically. They haven't come here to establish truth. They're not interested in true justice. Why is it the word justice seems to suddenly reverse its meaning when you put the word social in front of it? It's a complete mystery to me because, you know, justice, it's human rights, it's fair trials, it's rights over the state, things like that. These are tried and tested things in the West. We don't need to reinvent those things, basically. But when we start talking about social justice, it's this nebulous concept. Again, it's not defined anywhere. And it really is just to say a load of social justice warriors throwing their rattles out of their prams, basically. But these people have got to grow up. They've got to realise that you take responsibility for your words and actions. Those are the teachings of Jesus Christ in the Bible. They're the teachings of the Buddha. They're the teaching of anybody with any common sense at all, basically. And therefore, they've got to realise that, again, I talk to people now, and this is really, I'm warning people from the bottom of my heart that humanity, you've taken the piss for a very, very long time now. And if you don't correct what you're doing, the karma from this is going to make what we've been through so far look like a Sunday school picnic, basically. For people's own self-interest, they don't want to have to see their own children die in terrorist attacks. They don't want to have to be tortured and so on, because that's the karma that's coming for them if they funded those things, basically. And we don't live in like the past when people paid very little income tax. People are paying for this stuff. And again, that's why I say use my letter to stop paying the income tax. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, it pays the dole and things like that as well. If I gave somebody 100 quid to go and feed the poor, and he spent 70 quid on feeding the poor and 30 quid on beating people up, I'm not going to give him money again. I'm going to find somebody who's going to spend the 400 quid on the poor, basically.
Simple as that.
So that's not an excuse for why you've got to pay your taxes. Again, your taxes at the moment are per se unlawful. I'm telling you that if you carry on paying them, again, you're going to get bad karma because those taxes are being used to do all sorts of terrible things. And the dole, in the eyes of God, is not a good thing. The dole is a way of enslaving people after you've deprived them of an ability to look after themselves.
To do something for themselves, yeah.
Deprived of the access to the bounty of God's land, which he says, go and use. Go and use under my common law. No one else is using it. You go and use that. Feed yourself. Get some chickens. Grow some crops or whatever. And that's, again, what we've got to move towards. We're in what I now call the second industrial revolution. The fashion at the moment on the internet, they're talking about the fourth industrial revolution. I tried to research this and I couldn't find out what the other two are, unless they're talking about the Iron Age and the Bronze Age. But this second industrial revolution should see a movement out of the cities, back into the countryside, and more self-sufficiency, because we've now got better communications.
Basically. Well, this is the reason why this is a very good thing to talk about. We've got about 10 minutes left, sadly, but we can talk about that. And I do want to go back to where we came in, Salman Abedi. But before we do that, this is an excellent thing you're talking about. You see, you know as well as I do, the fracking agenda and other agendas, the geoengineering agenda, the Monsanto biotech agenda, is to get people off the land and away from rural areas and into urban human settlement zones, right? And we have to be aware of that. Because what you said is natural. Natural. It should be natural that we should migrate to the country, to the land, to live off the land sustainably, to look after the land, to treat the land properly, to take from it, to derive from it, to eat healthy, live healthy lives. But they're trying to destroy that. Right?
Ultimately. Well, everything done in civilization is bad for us, basically. Yeah. The most healthy people in the world are hunter-gatherers in the Amazon, basically. They have the healthiest hearts in the world. They work 4 hours a day on average to look after themselves, spend the rest of the time playing instruments, smoking weed, shagging, whatever they're doing. But they have a life.
Sounds good to me.
Have time to connect to God, those moments of peace, because that's another thing there. If I even saw the New Scientist about this the other day, science has now shown that the brain needs moments of quiet and peace to essentially restore itself. And that's what they've done in the modern world. They've tried to deny us any peace at all. In fact, I remember once when I was at Kew Bridge Eco Village, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was lying there awake, and suddenly I thought, what's going on? And I realized that for the first time since I'd been there, there was absolutely no traffic noise. This was 4 o'clock in the morning. About 30 seconds later, it started up again as well and didn't stop again.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I suddenly had this weird, like, what's going on? What's going on? Oh, my God, it's quiet. That should be the normal state. It's a bit like, you know, organic food. No, that's normal food. The other stuff should be labelled as full food full of crap.
Fair trade.
No, don't label fair trade. That's normal trade. If it's not fair trade, it's unfair trade. Label it unfair trade. That's where the labelling should go, not the other way around.
It's an inversion. It's 8.5 minutes to the top of the hour. We've just got just over 5 minutes left with David. So I'm going to go back to the beginning where we came in on this. David has said to us, that he's got evidence that that Salman Abedi's father, Ramadan Abedi, in the 1990s, he was heading up the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, but he was doing that basically at the behest of MI6. He was known as Agent Tunworth. This is extraordinary blowback, this, I suppose. You could say it's blowback on the British people because of the covert actions of our government and their intelligence agencies, but it has far more sinister implications than just that. David has contacted the British government, the leader of the opposition. He's also contacted national newspapers in this country with this information, and he has yet to receive an answer from them. And I suppose you're too experienced, David, not to know any better. You know you're not going to hear back from these people. If you want to sum up, before we run out of time, what the implications are for people in the UK, what do people in the UK need to take out of that information, that this guy was Agent Tunworth, that he was in it up to his neck with MI6 in the attempt to assassinate Gaddafi in 1996, which you, of course, screamed from the rooftops about all those years ago. What do people need to take out of that information?
What they need to know is that one attack that I blew the whistle on, obviously I left the service as a result of that, that then carried on with these guys called the Manchester Taliban, of which Salman does appear to be a part of it, and his father Ramadan, also associated with the Islamic Fighting Group. The MI6 appears to have been funding and training these people for a number of years, and they had a number of goes at Gaddafi over those years, basically. But at a time, not when Gaddafi was an enemy of the UK, but because Gaddafi was an enemy of the Zionists. So people say the intelligence services look after us. That has got to be the most naive and pathetic statement you can make. All of their stuff creates more war and more terror. That's why Manchester happened, basically. That's why we're getting these things in London. If you study terrorism, you'll know that tit for tat just escalates violence. So the entire foreign policies in the UK and the US in the last 15 years have been absolutely instrumental in raising violence on the planet in general, but also, therefore, indirectly causing the deaths like we saw in Manchester the other week, basically, last month. So they have blood in their hands. They also have blood in their hands as a principle of law that says the truth is all too frequently overpowered. So those who do not disapprove, approve. So those people who didn't listen to my evidence, those successive governments and so on, have joined an extremist Islamic terrorist conspiracy by not ensuring that it was investigated. And again, I can't stress this enough. You don't arrive at truth unless you do thorough investigations. This is one of the weird things about social justice warriors, is anything that works in their, it's like Zionists as well, anything that works in their favour is a fact. Anything against them is just some tenuous piece of theory or allegation or whatever. They don't assess the piece of information itself. They just apply to how that information supports their ideology, their blinkered worldview, and then they judge it according to that. And it's almost at the point now where these people seem to have forgotten how to carry out proper investigations. That was almost what happened when we saw the Hutton inquiry about 10 years ago.
David Kelly, yeah.
Yeah, the complete whitewash, because they don't know how to carry out an investigation. They're not actually, in the British state, it's all, again, I found this sort of liberal idea in MI5 that we're all very liberal, so we're okay. You know, we're murdering people or whatever, invading their privacy. But we've all got a piece of paper saying that's okay from the government, that's fine. We can still be liberals and pretend we're good. And that attitude, I say, is pervade everywhere, but it has no relationship with truth. It really doesn't. These intellectual types quite often have, I've got a degree, people have degrees and so on, but that's it. You know, I mean, once I got my degree at university, when I was at university, I was doing the student newspaper and the drama society. I was out getting pissed with my mates. I was taking drugs. I was there to experience life. And since then, I've gone on experiencing life. And some people say, oh, you know, I didn't go to university, but I've got a degree from the University of Life. I'll tell you now, I've got a doctorate from the University of Life. I really have, from what I've been put through. But the cliche is there. As a result of that, I am stronger for those experiences. And I know a damn sight more than any of those politicians. I know what's going on in the world. And I say, it's not when you tell me these things about Amber Rudd. I just hold my head in my hands. I want to cry. I say, these people nearly took us into the Third World War by accident, with all the suffering, the death, the incidental rape and so on that goes with it that will entail. And I say, it's just the fact they're so, so clueless, basically. So, I've got this experience. I know what I'm doing. I've got the law as well, which says all part of this whole thing. I understand the economics of their system enough to understand what's going on as well. So, in a sense, I'm saying to people now, I want to go forward with this. And if people want to help me, get in touch through the website or on my email address, dmshaler@yahoo.co.uk. That's dmshaler@yahoo.co.uk. And offer your services. Because I just can't sit around and be like this anymore. I need somebody to be kind of with me on this journey in some capacity. So I spent 6 months living a hand-to-mouth existence trying to promote a book that can save the world, basically. But obviously they know that as well. They know it's their weak point, so they've tried as hard as possible to stop me doing that.
I want to give a big plug to it again, because we're just about to run out of time. It's law.
Plug one other thing as well, Richard.
Yes, mate, go ahead.
I've got my novel up there. It's on Create Space at the moment. My novel, The Organisation, which is a very racy thriller set in the world of intelligence. But it's also part of my testament here, because I wrote it as an atheist. I wanted to write a novel about the meaninglessness of life as I saw it as an atheist. And then I read it 10, 15 years later as a believer, and realised that somehow I'd written a spiritual book. Even though, as an atheist, I thought I was writing something atheistic, even the extent I took every mention of Christ out of it and replaced it with the letter X, only to find out when I studied Kabbalah that the letter X means the teacher of righteousness, just another name for Christ. And I found that, a great lesson in the fact that where the will of man is at odds with the will of God will prevail, basically. And people have got to understand that, importantly, as part of this thing, it's a spiritual journey. Don't worry what other people think about you. Don't join in something that you think is wrong and don't think it's bad because you're not doing the bad bits. If you're contributing towards it, you've got collective common purpose karma, as it's called in law. You're a common purpose, and therefore, in God's law, you get all the karma from that. If you get any doubts about anything, don't join that group. If somebody comes to you and tells, say, lie or don't do this or whatever, don't do that. It may seem easier to think, well, I'll do that now and I'll have an easy life. But that's very, very short term, because the karma you're going to get from it in possibly even only a few months' time will be enormous. So better grit your teeth now and show some courage, show some balls, which not only social justice warriors really have, and stand up to these people. And believe me, that will shift your consciousness more than tuning up your chakras or going to something about gods or whatever. It's that true spirituality, the true Christ consciousness is being out there by the seat of your pants, often with no money, possibly not even knowing why you're doing what you're doing for God. But nevertheless, you go out and do it, and the whole universe is there with you. A whole lot of energy's come into play, so it goes a lot further. Anything else in terms of political activism requires lots and lots of people, and that can be very easily infiltrated and turned against you.
You can make a difference by yourself. You're absolutely right. Folks, it's at @gods_spy on Twitter, Law on Amazon. I'll put out links to David's new novel as well. And by the way, you can go to davidshaler.com. That was a rapid hour that made. It flew by. Don't leave it as long. It's been nearly 6 months since you're on the programme. Let's not leave it as long again. Thanks for sharing that information about Ramadan Abedi. It's absolutely sensational stuff. I have no doubt that it's true coming from you. And I look forward to you publishing that on your website. And when you do, we'll share it so that as many people as possible can see it. Thanks again and continued success to you, David.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for listening, Richie. It's great for me to be able to put these ideas out there and find a receptive audience. So I say, when people who stand up for them, thank you, mate. You'll get good karma.
It's an honour. And I mean that sincerely. Thank you, David. It's an honour. It's the reason the programme was put together in the first place. David Shaler on the line to us there from outside his home. It's exactly 19 minutes to the top of the hour. Just for a break, while you process that, let's have a little bit of music. Just a wee bit of music. Is it 19? It is 19 minutes past the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. You were just listening to David Shaler at @gods_spy and davidshaler.com. This is The Seeker from The Who, back in a minute.
I've no time to chair.
get to get what I'm after till the day I die. I won't get to get what I'm after till the day I die.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Welcome back to the program. Welcome back. Welcome back. It's exactly 14 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. I tell you what, it's been a busy old week. Sunday till Thursday, each of those days was scorching. The weather was extreme, wasn't it? And I'm feeling it a bit now, to be honest. And not in terms of I'm not feeling tired, like I'm going to fall asleep, but I'm feeling the strain of it this week. Busy old week, and that weather was oppressive. It'd be lovely to have it like this all the time. 18, 19 degrees, light breeze, eh? Wouldn't life be absolutely lovely? While we have a couple of minutes, let me tell you about a couple of things. David will be, you know, the Worldwide Wake Up Tour is on, and it continues later this year. Go to theworldwidewakeup.com, go to davidicke.com. You know that continues into 2018. But also, there will be three events, I think three, maybe four, but three that I know of anyway, later this year in the autumn to mark the launch of David's forthcoming book. And those events will be in London, Manchester and Edinburgh. There might be another one announced, I don't know. But the three I know of are London, Edinburgh and Manchester. It's a dinner event, Q&A with David. I'll be at the event in London and in Manchester. I have nothing to do with it, of course. It's all about David and David's book, but I'll be introducing it and I'll be helping with the Q&A section of the evening. It's promising to be three amazing evenings. If it's only three, there might be another one. I'll get that info, of course, and I'll give it to you in due course. For more details on that, simply go to davidicke.com. That's the website, davidicke.com, which is due to relaunch itself imminently. I think it was due to relaunch a week or so ago, but they weren't happy with it. They're tweaking it, but a brand new davidicke.com is in the offing. It's in the offing, I tell you. So there you go. That's the notice board section of the programme, brought to you in association with whoever. Hi to Bass Ninja, who thanks David for a very interesting programme, especially the information about the Abadi family and their links to MI6. Thanks for that. Hi to Faisal as well, and to Mark, who tweeted, great information and insight, David. David Shaler, do you speak in public these days, he says, or is that not possible? That's Mark to David. He's tweeted him directly, so I'm sure David will answer that in due course as well. Hi to Pele Jr., to Seth, to Salid. Let me squeeze on down to Scott, to Luga, to Jay Ferguson, to Jenny. A lot of tweets came in during that. Yeah, I'm such a plonker, me. Silence! What am I... Oh, yeah, I know what it is, yeah. You know, there's a checklist. Jesus! There's a checklist that I have to go through before I go on air every evening. One of the to-do things on the checklist is to mute computers that are not plugged into the radio mixing desk. And I didn't follow the checklist earlier on, hence the background noise there. Anyway, I was saying, as I was scrolling down the tweets there, hi to Steve Bruce. It's not the real Steve Bruce. Silly thing to say, it is the real Steve Bruce. Because if he's Steve Bruce, he is a real Steve Bruce. Hi to Gregory O'Brien. How you doing, Greg? To Charlotte Binns. Charlotte is in, is it Burnley, Charlotte? Somewhere around Burnley. Is it Burnley? Is it Burnley? Is it? It is Burnley, that's right, good old Burnley. The land of Aaron Calland is Burnley as well. You can tweet this programme at any time. It doesn't have to be during the on-air programme at Richie Allen Show. I don't always see the tweets, but when I do respond. Hi to Thomas as well. Founder Go Vegan Me. Thomas Parr, he tweets, it's great to listen to somebody like David who actually knows what he is talking about. Thank you for that discussion, says Thomas. Well, thanks to David Shaler for being around and doing it. And somebody tweeted, Richie, why don't you jump in there? We know you don't believe in God. No, I don't. But David Shaler knows that I don't believe in God. And we've had this discussion before. And I don't need to say this every time David invokes the name of the Creator. I don't need to put my oar in to remind people that I don't believe in God. It's not about me. It doesn't matter what I think or what I don't think. It only matters really what the guest thinks. I interject when we think the guest is bullshitting or pulling the wool over our eyes. But yeah, he's good. He's a good guy, is David. Really good guy. And I look forward to talking to him again on the programme in the future. So there you go. A couple of good guests coming up next week. Philip Giraldi, former CIA agent, is going to be with me on Monday. I will also be speaking next week with Stuart Swerdlow. We had a fantastic conversation with Stuart about 3 or 4 weeks ago. There was so much in it, we said we'd bring him back for an extended interview. And we're going to do that. I think his wife, Janet, might be joining in as well. Next Wednesday, we'll have them for the entire programme. Wonderful, wonderful stuff, that. Really important stuff. So Stuart is on the programme as well. And I'll keep you posted on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/ The Richie Allen Show and keep up to date with forthcoming guests, because I do publish there a couple of times during the day. I'm going to give up, and I have been threatening this for some time. Threatening is a very negative word. I've been saying for some time that I'm going to personally come off Facebook, and I'm going to use a kind of a dummy account to manage the Richie Allen Facebook show page. But I'm coming off Facebook because it is a echo chamber for the vacuous and the narcissistic. It really is rubbish. I really do believe that. And I believe because Facebook are employing these algorithms to promote the banal and to hide the, you know, the posts and the videos made by men and women that challenge the establishment, it's really not worth its while anymore anyway. And I'm kind of fed up with it. You know, publish a picture of your dog, which I've done as an experiment on many occasions. Ask your friends in advance to tell you if it shows up in their timeline. And it does, because it's your dog running around chasing a ball. And then give your friends the tip off that you're going to post a video of one of your guests, like David or Stuart Swerdlow or Maria Heller or whatever. You post it and less than 10% of your friends see it in their own timeline, even though they have chosen specifically that they want to see your posts first. So Facebook is just basically a vacuous load of bollocks for narcissistic people, and I'm tired of it. And I think it has no use. It certainly is not useful anymore in terms of getting information to people that ordinarily wouldn't hear it. Facebook is useless because its own machinations make it so that people who don't understand the information or don't, or who haven't been exposed to it, they're not going to get it through Facebook. YouTube and Google are doing Google are doing the same things. So I'm thinking my Facebook days are nearly numbered. I'll keep the Richie Allen Show page open so that people can go there if they want to find out who's coming up on the programme. But my own personal page is not long for the world. I'm not trying to inspire anybody else to do the same. I don't think I should be telling people what to do. But I see no point in it anymore. So therefore, I'm going to come off it. And I'm looking forward to that, to be honest. I will save whatever pictures and videos I need for personal use, and everything else will be deleted. And instructions will be sent to Facebook that it is permanently deleted, and that will be the end of that. Thought I'd share that with you. Now, coming up at 10 p.m. live on liveleak.com, the Live Leak show presented by Hayden Hewitt. Mania, complete mayhem, but some very, very pithy commentary on current events in amongst the mania. Check out Hayden Hewitt on liveleak.com at 10 p.m. UK time. That is in just over an hour's time. This programme and the interview with David, the entire programme will be on podcast in a few minutes' time. And the interview with David will be on YouTube very early tomorrow in the AM when I do it. Simon is without internet and will be until early next month. The bastard. He's not, he's a good guy. But he's left me to do all the YouTube stuff. Like I needed it. I really needed to be doing that over the last few weeks. Right, that's it. You and I will talk again on Sunday morning with Sunday View broadcasting live as usual at 11 a.m. UK time. That's Sunday morning at 11 a.m. British summer time. I look forward to your company then. In the meantime, have a lovely weekend. Try and disengage from the information and the enormity of it, and take some time in the countryside, in the forest, near a lake or whatever. Trust me, it has a wonderful effect on your spirits and gets you set for the week to come. That's what I'm going to do anyway. Going to go and watch some rugby league tomorrow night in St. Helens. But Saturday, it's out in the country or somewhere like that with the future Mrs. Allen. I'll see you on Sunday morning. Until then, look after yourselves and one another. Leaving you with Amy Winehouse. Thank you again to David Shaler. Top, top man is David Shaler. Love the man. I'll be back with you on Sunday. Bye for now. Have a great weekend. Bye now.
Spain, we're like how we are.